They have to have an ego because an ego is a reflection of your self-esteem. It's the value that you feel that you have and how well that translates into reputation and how other people see that. And so it's a matter of how you control it and respond to that reputation that's created by your self-worth that defines your ego.
Welcome to Lessons in Leverage, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of success. We'll help you unlock the secrets of leverage so you can amplify your impact in the world. Here is your host, Spencer Lowe.
Welcome back to another episode of Lessons in Leverage. I'm excited to have Jim here with me today. He goes by the pen name J.L. Hancock, and he's a very interesting guy with a very interesting story that I think is going to add a lot of value to our audience. He spent 20 years in the military where he toiled away in the dark corners of government intelligence communities. He learned Korean and Japanese and conducted over 100 combat operations with special operations forces in Iraq, Afghanistan, and the Philippines. Then as a senior enlisted advisor over future concepts and innovation for the Navy, he became a well-known subject matter in unmanned systems, 5G, and artificial intelligence. Then drawing from a graduate level education in national security studies, foreign language expertise, and experiences of technicians embedded with special operations forces, he started to write fiction that reflects the complexities of the modern world. So he's inspired many lives and is someone that has seen so much. So he's living today in San Diego and joining us from there. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. I think the question on everyone's mind with that background is 5G going to kill us all?
Not yet. No, not quite. No.
All right.
It's funny. I had a separate podcast asked me the same thing, and we went into a very long diatribe about that. So that's
maybe we won't get into the long form now, but maybe as we get back to that, if you have some interesting thoughts, always happy to hear them. But with that being said, I want to go back. I want to start out, a little bit. Just share a little bit with us about your upbringing. Where you grew up and what led you into the military originally. One of our kind of key beliefs is that a lot of people, there's these key moments in our life, right? We make these decisions. A lot of us are just kind of doing what seems like the right path. And then as you go through life, you start to have these big moments that open you up to learning skills, experiences, beliefs that start to increase the leverage that you have. So when you go back to before all the exciting stories we just talked, what was Jim like growing up and what took you to the military?
That's a good question. I think growing up, I grew up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I spent the bulk of my time as a latchkey kid, just more or less riding my bike, doing whatever I wanted to the Mesa, the western part of Albuquerque. If you've seen Breaking Bad, you see them driving around and doing stuff. That was my backyard growing up, just chasing rattlesnakes and trying not to get beat up by gangs. So that was the exciting part of my early childhood. I would describe myself as timid. I wouldn't call myself weak, but I wasn't strong. That's one way of putting it. It was, and so, but then I was into sports and things, but when I was 10, my older brother got jumped and his jaw broken and I had to have it wired shut for the entire summer. And because of that, my grandparents were like, hey, well, we don't want the same thing happening to little Jimmy. So they had me put into martial arts. And that started a very long career in martial arts. Ended up competing internationally at one point in time. I went to Australia, competed in the Junior Olympics in America. It was a really big part of my life, as well as swimming. But that more or less really, that was one major pivotal moment in my life that changed the direction. And it gave me a lot of confidence, and I changed my personality dramatically because of all the mentorship that I received through my martial arts instructors. And then eventually I joined the military. Go ahead. Yeah.
I just wanted to touch on that for a second. It's a common story. It's one I've heard from several people of finding either martial arts or sports, or in this case, both early in their life, having that structure really be a source of self-esteem. I wonder, what do you think it was about that experience that really drove that for you, those results, really made that something meaningful? Because I'm sure there's people who go to some karate lessons and don't get anything out of it. And there's other people who get involved with martial arts and it really builds part of their character. What did you find to be so building and so formative for you?
One was establishing confidence in my own abilities. The other was having that confidence instilled in me from others. I had a natural drive but that needed nurturing. And when I was, so I started martial arts when I was 10 with one instructor, and I kind of almost had my own little Karate Kid story where one of my instructors, I had my initial instructor eventually wasn't taking me to competitions, and I didn't feel like I was being pushed hard enough. And another school opened up near my house, and I started training there a little bit when I had time. And long story short, my first instructor eventually found out about it, started making threats to me, and made me choose. And the other instructor was saying, you know, I'm just here to support you in whatever you need to do in your life. And the other one was basically telling me that I was his, and everything that I'd accomplished basically was because of him. And when comparing the two, an aspect of who was giving me agency and the freedom to make my own decision versus the one that wanted to control me, it was easy for me to make the decision. After I switched to that other school, the other instructor ended up coming and threatening the other instructor. It's crazy. But I made the right choice. I ended up training with my instructor's instructor, who was the head of the system that we were at the time. He was in the International Martial Arts Hall of Fame. He had 3 eighth degree black belts. He had fought with Chuck Norris, and he was a Green Beret in Vietnam. He had this crazy background that he could pull from and that he used to teach us. And so it was not just a matter of him teaching us interesting aspects of how to defend ourselves, but it was all about context, and it was about what was meaningful and effective in our lives every day, and how to use that in every conversation and everything that we do. And I think the biggest lesson came, and I've said this in other podcasts as well, but the biggest thing he taught me that I remember from when I was a kid is he said, you need to learn how to be an egotist, but not be egotistical. And he was specifically referring to that as what that means in the ring, but it was something that became almost a mantra for my entire life. And what that means is this: to be an egotist is an individual that understands that you have an ego, and everyone has an ego. I don't care who you are. You can't say that person has no ego. They have to have an ego, because an ego is a reflection of your self-esteem. It's the value that you feel that you have, and how well that translates into reputation and how other people see that. And so it's a matter of how you control it and respond to that reputation that's created by your self-worth that defines your ego. Now, an egotist maintains control of that. And as my instructor taught us, he said, you're always holding something back from what everybody knows you can do. And you're always developing and building what you have inside, so that you can always bring something forward, bring something new to the table. And you're always having to develop new skills and become smarter. And you're having to push yourself at all times, because you need to be that egotist who controls your ego and stays ahead of it, so that when you step in the ring, you always know something that your opponent does not. And there's something that you have that you can pull out of the ring that will completely destroy your opponent. And then on the opposite end, he said, an individual who's egotistical is somebody who has allowed their ego to take control of them, and they are no longer in control of their reputation. They are chasing it. They're chasing the meaning of their reputation. And because of that, they suffer from imposter syndrome. They become arrogant. They become ineffective in whatever it is they're trying to accomplish. And I saw that throughout everywhere in my life when I ran into individuals who had become egotistical when at first they started as an egotist. And that probably was the most impactful thing I learned through martial arts. It wasn't just the ability to defend myself or the ability to compete and to win martial arts tournaments. It was about growing as an individual, understanding my role as I interact with people. And that's something that to this day, when I interact with people, I try to view every situation as an egotist, not as somebody who's egotistical.
Man, that's such a great learning and insight. And I think there's just so much leverage in that belief. It's allows you to get more out of yourself, allows you to have that confidence, allows you to achieve and to drive towards that ambition that you have, and yet to also find this great strength in controlling it and holding something back and having that set of discipline. I just think that's such a powerful belief that, like you said, far expands beyond just martial arts. So I can see how that was so formative for you. So moving past that, I did kind of interrupt you, you know, moving past that, keep us moving on your journey of then how you built on that.
The So later on around, I spent some time in Japan, and then I came back from overseas, and then that was the, my buddy was like, hey, let's go talk to the recruiters. Yeah, he really wanted to join the military. I didn't have any desire to join the military. My grandfather was a colonel in the Air Force, and he really wanted me to join the military, but it was something that I was never interested in. Just, I thought it was cool, but I didn't think it was the path of, that I was going to go in my life until 9/11 happened. And this, so the month before 9/11, I was at the recruiting station. I'd gotten some information from the Navy recruiters, but I kind of just brushed it aside, was like, I'll think about it. And then 9/11 took place, and I genuinely felt that that was my generation's call to arms. And because that was my generation's call to arms, I wanted to find a niche in which I could apply my existing skills to help my country. And since I spoke Japanese, I thought, well, maybe I can learn another foreign language. And they told me about something called the Defense Language Institute, where they military cryptologists go and learn foreign languages. It's a very, very difficult school to get into. Cryptologists are second only to nuclear technicians in their the complexity of their acumen and the difficulty of their schools. And so I tested, and I scored and got in. And then I had to take this thing called the Defense Language Aptitude Battery, which is a test that you take to see whether how well you can learn foreign languages. And I scored really high on that. And then next thing I know, I was going to boot camp and joining the Navy. But the path of what I intended to do when I first joined the Navy versus where I ended up was completely opposite directions. I started off just wanting to learn foreign languages, but then I ended up becoming a cryptologist along the way. And cryptologists, to describe what they do, is there's a bunch of different flavors, as we like to say, of cryptologists, each one with a different specialization. But the baseline thing that a cryptologist does is they are different from people like IT. IT or comms people are those who want to make sure that your computers are up and running, that your radios are working, and that communications can take place. Individuals that do electronic warfare on the or electronic attack on the other end are people that use radio waves to shut off the ability for people to communicate, shut down their equipment, or degrade their ability to conduct surveillance and reconnaissance. I'm in between those two. I like to sit in the middle of communication and just collect all of it and listen in. That's what cryptologic linguists do. However, in the process of becoming a cryptologic linguist, I also started really enjoying radio frequency theory and how radio waves work. Also, though, I felt as though I was basically sent to a facility where it was air conditioned, it was nice and comfortable. I was based out of Hawaii, and everything was nice, but there was a war going on, and I felt like I wasn't doing my part. And then I found out about this program where they take a very, very small number of cryptologists from the entire Navy, and you screen. You have to do the same physical screening as the SEALs or SWCC operators. And then you have another baseline, other screening schools you have to go through. But through this program, you could be embedded inside of the special operations platoons and community. And not just sitting in the rear gathering intelligence, you're actually embedded in the platoon doing every mission that they do. And that's what I ended up screening for and getting accepted into in 2007. And then I ended up in that community for almost the rest of my career. And so those were, if I were to say, two pivotal points in my life. One was my brother getting hit and put in the hospital, and then me joining the martial arts, and the other being 9/11 and me joining the military.
I think that's such an interesting pattern that everyone could probably think about and learn from is, the most important things that happen in our life are usually adversity. They're challenge, they're pain. And that can be this inciting event. If you have the right mindset, you could let those things cripple you and disorient you, disable you, and leave you feeling helpless and doing nothing. Or they can be this catalyzing event that leads to you taking action and responding and growing to meet the challenge. And that can become some of the most meaningful outcomes in your life in response to those. And I think that's such a powerful pattern that you have kind of captured there in your life, of these key points where you experienced something or were exposed to some form of adversity that then gave you an opportunity to grow, learn new skills. I love that. For one other clarification I wanted to make, just on what you shared, cryptology versus sort of languages. For anyone listening, cryptology, my understanding is that that's more sort of code-based. Do I have that right? Or what would you tell people that are trying to understand? Obviously, you're learning foreign languages. You want to intercept those communications. is the cryptology part, being an expert in sort of decoding or understanding things that maybe they're trying to avoid you understanding or capturing, or how would you describe that portion versus the language part?
Yeah, so cryptology is, like I said, there's a lot of different flavors of cryptologists. So there are individuals that specialize only in the signal. There are individuals that specialize in radar that do cryptology. There are individuals that do computer networks exploitation. And all of those individuals, what they basically are doing is they're trying to exploit. And there's some there's an element of cryptanalysis in there. There's an element of cryptography in there. There's how you decode, how you create code, how you manipulate code. It's all those are components of what a cryptologist has to learn how to do. But the specialization is that, like in the Navy, we have these things called rates. Other branches of service, they call them MOSs.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like your base job, right? And then the arm, and the, like you're the army, it's got like a different number and a letter associated with it, and say with the Marine Corps and the Air Force. But the Navy, what we do, the rate is your rank and your community combined into one thing, so that when somebody tells you what their rank is, you actually immediately know what their job is at the same time. So for me, I was a CTI, cryptologic technician interpretive. So you immediately knew I understand cryptology, but I specialize in foreign languages. But if I walked in, I said I was a CTR, that meant I focused on collections. I was mainly focused on understanding how radio waves, the signals themselves of the radio waves, or reporting on those things. That's what a CTR would do. And so, yeah, and then your rank would come after that. So, for example, I retired as a Navy senior chief. So if in my title, it says CTICS. And so that stands for Cryptologic Technician Interpretive Senior Chief. And so, or chief senior, because there's a chief and then chief senior, then a master chief. And so that's how you break that out. But yes, you're right in the sense that the codes are an aspect of being a CT or a cryptologist, but that's not all of it, right?
Mm. Yeah, so there's several different aspects. When I first, in my education, when we studied cryptology, someone said something to the effect of, you know, it's sort of the basis of all communications, in that all the communications we use today, in that we wouldn't have a way of knowing, are we talking to the right person? Is this secure? Any sort of secure connection or access? Like, there's all these sort of principles underneath there that most of us never consider, and certainly I never spent time learning about, that is really interesting to think about, that there's all these complex problems that exist in communication and in the internet that most of us interact with that we don't even know is going on. And certainly then there's all the warfare and sort of, you know, military applications of that. But I love how you've broken it down. There's sort of all these components that are things that we all just take for granted, that the normal person doesn't even know are going on. I don't maybe know how my browser is sort of sending data and maybe hiding things or keeping things secret, or how my password systems work or whatever. A lot of people don't know. These are very basic things, and yet they're fundamental to everything. And so there's all these ways that it can be exploited, you know. And so that's, knowing that that's the case, I'm very excited to hear a little bit about then where you got involved and what your experience was, and how that gave you leverage, how that gave you additional power to create meaningful outcomes. I think you were in the military for a total of like 20 some years, right? So where did that go? You get into cryptology, where did that start to build into, and what were some of the outcomes that created for you?
So what started as me being a linguist and studying Korean evolved into me screening for special operations communities and ended up deploying with SEAL Team 7 to Iraq in 2009, and then again with SEAL Team 5 after that, and then to Afghanistan with an organization called the Joint Special Operations Command. And so I got to interact and fight with pretty much every branch of the military and all of their special operations units to an extent. Not every single one of them, but the vast majority. So I understand what it's like to be on a mission with each one of them, and what makes them tick, the motivation, the types of personalities that are associated with those groups. But what I like the most about it is when people are like, what does your job actually mean? And I'd be like, well, you know, when you watch a movie and for some reason there's some guy in the platoon with a computer telling everybody where to go, that was basically me. So I was the guy with the weird technology that could tell everybody where to go to find whatever it is we're looking for. I wasn't the most important. I was the most important part of the mission for about 5 seconds, right? Until I call the house. And then once the house is called, it's get back in the back of the stack. I'm like, okay, that's fine. And that was it. Like, I didn't want any other part. But for that short period of time, the whole mission like was on my shoulders, and I loved that pressure. I loved it because if I didn't call the right spot, we hit the wrong target. We didn't find the person we were after. And that part of the mission set, I could not find that adrenaline rush really anywhere else, because it's one thing to be like the person in the front who has to kick in the door. It's another thing to be like the whole mission rides on you. You can't turn to somebody else to say, help me out here. There was no option. It was just me. I was by myself. And so that led to forcing me to think from an innovative perspective on pretty much every problem, because there was no fallback. There was no option to say, okay, I'm sorry, I messed up. Can you help me? There was no. It was just, that was it. Like if I got into a vehicle and my gear wasn't working, fix it. Like no one's going to come running around to come and help you out. Nobody there knew how my gear worked except for me. And so it was all on my shoulders all the time. And 90% of my job was troubleshooting, was trying to fix things, because guess what? Crap breaks all the time. Or they would be like, when I was with in Iraq, they couldn't get it straight before an op, which vehicles we were going to take. So I was constantly swapping my gear between these larger vehicles called RG-33s, which are the big like MRAP vehicles, the V-shaped hull, or a Humvee. And that all depended upon what part of the city we're going to go to, because the power lines were really low in certain parts of the city. So we couldn't drive the RGs in there because they get caught on the power lines. But then we didn't want to ride the Humvees all the time because they made us susceptible to IEDs, right? So we were always having to balance that out. And every time we got into a different vehicle, I had to connect directly into the power source of the vehicle so I could run my systems. And it was just this dance that I had to do. But the thing is, in the process of that and having to learn how to solve all my problems, I look at the world very differently now than I did before. I don't look at the world as if, okay, who's going to bail me out? I don't look at it as though I'm always an individual at the same time. I recognize that I have an impact to a greater whole of people, as well as I understand that if something's going to get done, there's always a creative solution. And that eventually led to me becoming the senior enlisted advisor of an organization at the headquarters of the SEAL teams called the Future Concepts and Innovation Directorate. I was a plank owner in that office. So it was several other people and myself. We stood this office up and we were in charge of basically identifying concepts, future concepts and models for how technology could be employed in the battlefield of the future. However, that also led to us doing things that impacted the battlefield much sooner than we realized. So for example, in 2018, I helped put the first artificial intelligent drone in combat. And that started not because someone asked us to, it's because we were trying to find innovative solutions to problems. And we found this one, but I won't go into the complications of military acquisitions processes, but just because something's cool doesn't mean anyone's asking for it. It also doesn't mean there's money to buy it. And so I had to become a specialist in other people's money. And that was, and finding funding from other places. In my office, they said, we'll pay for your travel, but you're not allowed, you don't get a budget. You don't have money to buy anything. You don't have money to do research and development. However, you could travel as much as you like. And that's it. But you're free to do whatever you want. I said, okay. So by the time I left, I had pulled in $400 million in other people's money. And I was running about 40 different projects, some of which that were worth over $100 million plus a piece. And some of the companies that we worked with, I would say several of them, a couple of them are unicorns now. They started with like 10 people that was when they started working with us, and now they're worth about $3 billion. And so all of those things came about because when I was in that older job, it was like, okay, how are you going to make this happen in light of the fact that other people are going to be in your way almost the entire time? And so I had to learn with one, the whole concept of starting with why, what motivates everyone from the beginning. And then the other part of it being when someone says no, determining whether that's an objection or a rejection. And most of the time it's an objection. And most of those objections were bureaucratic. Very rarely were they technological. Were they economic? They were almost always bureaucratic problems. And so because of that, there was a way around it. There was an innovative way to solve the problem. if I took the pressure away from them and I put it on someone else, would they still be, would they become an advocate? And it always came down to the other. So there, most of the time the rejections were due, or the, what basically became an objection in the end, was because people didn't understand enough. So their default answer is no. And when I started seeing the world that way, I found that I could get a lot more done, because it was, okay, do I recognize what's most important in this situation? And can I advocate for my case? And as long as I can advocate for my case while recognizing the concerns of other people, I get a lot more done.
So was this other parts of the military that you'd have to go advocate for in terms of finding this budget? You had ideas on your research and what you were looking into of ways you could impact the battlefield. You find some innovative technologies, or you have some ideas around ways that we might be able to implement new technologies or new solutions. And because you don't have a budget, you then had to go out to people in the Air Force, the Navy, the whatever branches, intelligence communities, et cetera, and get them on board, get that buy-in that they should actually allocate their dollars towards that research for a goal they had. Is that, do I have that understanding right of kind of what you were having to navigate there?
To an extent, yeah. Except the only difference is that there are organizations that are branch agnostic that do research and development. Then there are branch specific. And then there are, but there's a massive ecosystem of groups doing this work. There are, and that ranges from everything from massive projects that are, that have their own like capture teams run by huge primes. What I mean by that is, like, when Lockheed Martin bids for a $1 billion project, they have a team of people that gets together that builds the proposal for those things. This is not, and they do long-term marketing campaigns to build, get themselves ready and get in the minds of people before the solicitations go out. It's a long, long process. What I was doing was, yes, some of those were just direct branches of service, but most of the time they didn't have money. I needed advocacy from them and sustainment. I needed them to say, yeah, I'm more than happy to support this in the long run if it goes somewhere. But a lot of times I was like, hey, it's just a concept. The other thing that we would do is every quarter I ran these things called limited objective experiments. And my buddies and I, there's literally three of us in this office. And so we would go out to a military installation for about 2 weeks. And we had this trailer that we could operate out of. And we went to this one small airfield, and we would work with vendors, national laboratories, other service personnel. And then we would integrate these large technology solutions together. At the same time, I had a rule that you couldn't work in my office unless you had your own project. And what I mean by that is everyone was turning wrenches. I had my own projects. Both of the people that worked for me had their own projects. When they left and somebody else came in, the in test that I had for them is I gave them a box of broken drone parts and access to the internet. And I said, build me a drone. And they'd be like, I don't know how to do that. I'd be like, figure it out. You got a week. And so by the end of that week, if they didn't have a flying drone, I sent them away because they didn't have the right mindset. If the mindset is, you have to teach me how to do this, and I was like, I don't want you. I don't have time to sit here and teach you all these things. All I have to know is whether or not you have the right mindset. And the mindset came down to, in my mind, two attributes, being having humility to recognize the fact that you're not the smartest person in the room. And then grit to have the wherewithal to recognize that you can become that if you just work hard. And so it's the same thing that eventually led to a lot of individuals getting in these, especially special operations community, pushing themselves physically to get to where they are. But in this case, I wasn't as interested in how your physical acumen, I was interested in your mental acumen and what you're doing to constantly feed that and to develop it and to learn and then put pieces together. And that's what our team did, is we were constantly turning wrenches, finding solutions, integrating them in with other people, breaking things really quickly, recognizing what were going to be failures and waste of time and what were going to work, and then coming back and telling everybody all the things that we learned from it. It became an incredibly useful tool for the other individuals that didn't have time to do that because other bureaucratic processes had been put in place to more or less stymie their innovation. They kind of just were like, you have these right and left limits, and this is all that you're allowed to do. And that is more or less the general institutionalized mentality of most of the military. And we didn't adhere to that. We completely ignored it. And Yes, but we still knew how to understand. We still understand that ecosystem and how to work within it. But our mentality was focused on outward interaction and how we solve problems without thinking in such a limited means.
Yeah, that's an interesting dichotomy for any organization that gets big. And Military is a pretty big organization. There becomes this weight of bureaucracy, this weight of process, of risk management, of overhead, of all these things that become heavy and stifle innovation. They put all the barriers around you, the limits on what you can do, where you can go, et cetera. And yet you need innovative solutions. And so you have to find a way to sort of create this little bubble of, we're going to ignore some of these rules. We're going to push beyond some of these limits. We're going to question some of the assumptions. We're going to think more like entrepreneurs, honestly, more creatively and less, more like a tiny organization would and less like the big organization would. And so it sounds like you guys had this really strong, almost entrepreneurial internal subculture to be able to go solve problems and come up with solutions and press on assumptions. And that's a really powerful thing. One of the questions I have for you is, in that environment, it can also be hard to gauge success. It can also be hard because you're sort of on charting your own path. And so as the leader of that little team and organization, how did you think about measuring success? What did you do to sort of hold yourself and your team accountable to understand, are we having the impact and the results that we want to have?
So in that team, ROI was pretty easily evaluated. Hmm. It's actually the rest of the military where there is no ROI. And ROI is measured by process, not so much by the actual result. So for example, for the average warfighter, you can't value the individual by how many heads they catch or how many heads they take, right? Hmm. We don't want to measure by how many people we kill. That's a terrible way of measuring things.
We did that.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely wrong. And so what we do then is we say, okay, this person followed this process. This person saved the government this much money. This person trained this many people. This many successful operations took place. But define a successful operation, so vague. Whereas my job was pretty easy. Did I transition that technology or not? Did it result in something people could use or not? And so my measure of success initially was, how much R&D funding am I getting? And my first year, it was like $1 million, $2 million. Second year was $10 million. Third year, it was $20 to $40 million. And by the fourth year, I was making over $400. It was almost growing exponentially by the amount of projects we were running and then the size we were going and our ability to pitch. And so we could come back and say, all right, this is how much money I pulled in. That's ROI one, but that's not the most important thing. I don't really care about spending money. I'm interested in what that money leads to. One of the concepts, then we started, but the concepts themselves were the most important thing. So some of those bigger projects were other people's money, so it was their risk. So it wasn't really like I was bringing it in and I had a piggy bank and I could execute the funding. Go ahead.
Who are the people? Like, what types? Is this businesses? Is this, who are the other people whose money is coming in?
That's other parts of the Office of Secretary of Defense or the Department of Defense. It's their money.
Okay.
So like I said, there's other research and development organizations that have their own cash that's been allocated to them by Congress to conduct research and development. But they're also looking all the time for what they're going to spend that money on. They also need to execute it within a certain period of time. And in order to execute it, they have to get things on contract and everything has to be planned ahead. And so you have to pitch within a certain period of time. And then this, usually the industry is on the receiving end of this. They're waiting on websites like SAM.gov for a solicitation to come out that they can respond to that they might win. I was on the front end of that being like, what solicitation are you putting out? You should put out something that goes along the lines of this particular project. And then they'd be like, well, is that something that you can use? And now I couldn't, in my job, I couldn't commit my organization to it. But I was like, I will give you feedback. I'll find advocacy. I can find other or branches of service that are interested. However, this is an R&D concept and we are not in a reactive state. So, for example, most of the the system by which the government acquires technology is called the JCIDS process, Joint Capabilities Integrated Development System, JCIDS. JCIDS was created by Secretary of State McNamara in the 1960s, And it was a modeled reflection of the Soviet acquisition process. And the reason why we did that is because we didn't want to outpace the Soviets at a speed that would escalate the Cold War beyond manageable levels. And so JSIDS has governors built into it to slow down acquisition milestones. We still use JSIDS to this day, but we never removed those milestones and we never removed those speed bumps. And so it slows us down technologically. The other two, because the two things inside of JSIDS that drive its movement and drive capability needs are either gaps in identified gaps and deltas, and the other is an event. So we got into war. We recognize the fact that we have IEDs that we have to handle. All of a sudden, a bunch of money is dumped into the JSIDS process to solve IEDs. However, the other side is with gaps, you have to prioritize your gaps. You say, well, I know that IEDs may be a problem, but they're not a problem for us right now. More importantly, I don't have enough money to replace all the guns that we have. For example, I'm just giving a random example. So they'll, on that, as they rack and stack those priorities, they come back and they say, well, we're going to give you money for guns. We're not going to give money for V-shaped hulls for IEDs. Okay. And so then all of a sudden the next year they come back and they pitch the same thing, but now another priorities come up. So sometimes things will keep getting, the can will keep getting kicked down the road and doesn't get funded. And then the warfighter, all of a sudden they start having dilapidated technology at certain points. So they have to prioritize things based upon a reactive state. Science and technology research and development, on the other hand, is the opposite of that whole process. And individuals that are stuck with this whole needs-based solutioning, they hate the idea of creating technology and then finding an application for it. But that's how science works. Science doesn't, you don't come up with a new scientific thing because of the fact that you're trying to solve an individual application. It becomes about, they try to see whether or not the physics of it work out. And then when the engineering improves the physics, all of a sudden then they're like, well, what does this actually mean? And that's where true innovation comes about, right? And that's why all of a sudden we have a revolutionary change. I mean, Henry Ford said this all the time, and this is a very common quote in the innovation space. When people asking Henry Ford, he's like, "Why?" They said, why did you build the car? And he said, well, every single time somebody, I'm misquoting it right now, but said, if I were to ask people what they wanted, they would say, I want a faster horse. They wouldn't say, I want a car. And so we're trying to find the car while the rest of the community is trying to find a faster horse, iterative versus disruptive. And I was chasing disruptive change. And so if I walked into a space and somebody showed me something that I knew was on the iterative roadmap of these other organizations, I ignored it. I was like, sounds good. That's great. I'm not interested in that. It's not my lane. And so that's where, that's like I said, the first AI drone. People were playing with quadcopters a little, but nobody saw the value of it when we started working with them. And then about a year and a half later, we're on the forward line of troops in Syria, and suddenly the ISIS is dropping grenades from drones onto our heads. And then you fast forward a little bit more, you have the Armenian-Azerbaijani war, where they, up in Nagorno-Karabakh, the second Nagorno-Karabakh war, and drones became the primary thing, and then that led to Ukraine, right? So that evolution was taking place before, and we were picking up on it. But we were looking at it from the standpoint of, okay, yes, teleoperated drones will work. That's great. But what happens if the enemy has a very advanced electronic warfare capability and can jam the entire spectrum? Now my teleoperated drone won't work. How do I still do my mission? And so we said, well, how do we make these things automated so they can conduct their missions without a human being in the loop? And that's where we started working on it. That was in 2016. So 8 years ago, we were chasing this down to try and solve these problems that we're seeing proliferating right now. So we were directly on trajectory where we needed to be. We were seeing the path. Lots of people were, but nobody was willing to execute on it. And so we just created the appropriate vision. And so one of the other things we did, we talk about ROI, is we turned all everything I just said into a concept. It was called AI for small unit maneuver. We created another one called AI for maritime maneuver. Those projects now have been accepted by certain elements within the DoD, and they are now multi-million dollar long-term sustained efforts from both a research and development standpoint as well as a warfighter interface standpoint. Total, between all of them, the amount of money that will be put into it and being put into it is well over $500 million. And that came from us playing in a trailer. And so the ROI for us, we say, hey, this from a little bit of e-money for us to travel and a little bit of money from this to build the drones and to play with the concepts and to work with the company to build out an initial concept, we were able to expand dramatically. And it wasn't even an order of magnitude greater return. It was well beyond that. I wouldn't say it's exponential, but it was close to it in the amount of money that we were able to pull back. And so that was my success. But to further highlight the complexities of the military, as a senior chief cryptologist, when my evaluations went to the board for promotion, I had all these numbers saying I brought in $400 million and I put the first AI drone in combat. Those guys in that community came back and they looked at my eval and they said, yeah, but what are you doing for Navy linguists? How are you making Navy linguists better? And I said, I don't know, man. I'm not doing anything for Navy linguists. They said, cool. Then stay where you are. You're not ready to promote. And so I kept getting passed over for promotion because I was not helping my community. I was helping the entire Department of Defense and I was solving problems for actual future warfare. And it killed my career. However, I knew that and I was okay with it. And so I got to stay there for 6+ years. The Admiral personally wanted me to stay in that job because of the impact that we were having. Since then, they've tried bringing me back as a civilian and I've turned them down. I needed to move on, but it not because I don't think that it's an amazing opportunity or that I've done the same thing for 6.5 years. I wanted to branch out so I could support other groups. And I also wanted to enjoy being a civilian for a while. So yeah, so that's fair. Kind of like, yeah, that's where everything ended up. But it was an interesting path.
So as you
started with something.
As you're getting to that point then where you've got all this experience, first of all, major lesson there I think the audience can benefit from. I mean, sometimes the systems are not designed to reward you for something that is rewarding or to reward you for something that is long-term valuable for you. And so sometimes you have to be willing to forgo the short-term promotion to get a skill set and to do something that either has an impact that's going to be really purposeful for you or, and in some cases both, is going to create a skill set that will also be long-term high value for you. And so as you realize that maybe that was ending your career in the Navy, but you now had a whole new set of skills or had expanded your skill set significantly, your experiences, everything, you had way more leverage to go do something else. You know, one of those things was fiction. I want to hear sort of from your perspective, what then was that transition like to say, right, what am I going to do with this skill set and why? And we'd love to hear the various ways you thought about that and then what it led to of post-military life.
It's a good question. The fiction aspect was kind of happened by accident. It started with one thing. One, it started, once again, as you said before, it started with some type of adversity. And I reacted to that adversity, and that's kind of the result was something I hadn't anticipated. In this case, it was cancer. Wasn't anything crazy, but I had melanoma, and I ended up having to get about 6 inches of my back cut off and lymph nodes cut out. But it hadn't passed beyond stage 1B. However, it was still cancer. So I started having a bit of I wouldn't call it an existential crisis, but I started dramatically thinking about how I was spending my time, why I was spending my time that way, and what it all meant. And this was in 2019. This was like right in the peak of me doing this job that I thought was the most important thing ever. And I had this very strong compulsion that I needed to write, but I didn't know what. And it wasn't until a year later where I was at Caltech at this place called the Athenaeum. It's a meeting place, but it's like that you can become a member there and dine there, but it's by Caltech invitation only. But like Einstein used to give lectures there, and very prominent historical location inside of Caltech. Well, I was at the Athenaeum and a friend of mine was giving a lecture on artificial intelligence, and so were some of the professors from Caltech. Some Nobel laureates were there. And this one individual went up and started talking about something called optogenetics, and I'd never heard of it before. And as she explained how optogenetics work and how they were using machine learning to identify certain proteins to treat people with Parkinson's, it's like the entire plot for the book popped in my head. And I went home that night and I started writing. And I wrote for about 6 months. And then I had a first draft of my book done. And that, all this, I just fell in love with it. I loved it. A vehicle for exploring some of my ideas that I hadn't considered. It pushed me because it was very scary to be vulnerable, to allow people to just completely criticize your work. And I don't think people appreciate enough how hard it is to take something that means so much to you and give it openly to the public for them to tell you, for them to score it. I hadn't, and I was an unknown entity because I had been working in a community where I didn't want anyone to know I exist. And suddenly I need people to know I exist, right? So I needed to market myself, and I had to actually create social media accounts because I deleted all of them because there was no reason for me to have social media accounts in my old job, especially when I was deploying. It was a danger to me to have any of that stuff. So I didn't have any. So I was getting out of the military. And so the day of my retirement ceremony is when I published my book. It's a mixture of the things that I went through in the military, some of the personal trials that I had. A lot of it is from my friends and the trials they dealt with. Like, a lot of the book is about post-traumatic stress, which I don't have, but a lot of my friends suffered from it. And a lot of that is integrated into the characters in my book and the struggles they have. But the bulk of it, though, are concepts that I had come up with while I was working at the Innovation Directorate that I couldn't put anywhere. And so by putting them into a form of fiction, I was able to articulate some of those ideas in a way that I think could draw an audience in and teach them about the technology while entertaining them at the same time.
That's awesome. So as you have that revelation, you're getting out of the military, you write the book, and I imagine some of that you just mentioned, you know, it incorporates stories and it captures experiences. It's this big part of who you are. I'm curious about how much motivation of that was also wanting to express your vision of the future or some of the things coming in the future, because I've not read your book. So was there any about piece of writing that, as you've been involved in sort of technological development and seeing where things are going, is there any part of that that is an outlet for you of maybe imagining that future or warning or sort of drawing awareness to the ways that technology in our world might be going?
Yeah, that was a big part of the book. I mean, there's certain things that when you read it, you're like, oh, that's pretty common nowadays. Granted, I wrote the book 4 years ago originally. I published it 2 years ago. And I'm getting ready to turn the sequel into my editor. There's forecasting in the story. There is also, I'm not ratcheting certain things up or trying to be a scaremonger about it, but I am pointing out some issues associated with AI, but I also am exploring elements that aren't being discussed. And that was where that whole optogenetics part comes in that made the story very interesting. It was an angle on that topic that I don't think anybody had ever considered.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think there's a lot that needs to be considered there. And fiction is such a powerful way to do it because it allows us to sort of combine the facts that we know with the potential philosophical, moral, long-term implications and explore it in a story where we can really rationalize it and wrestle with it and think about it and maybe prepare for it. I think that's such a powerful, so you look at fiction that's been written throughout history, how much of it either comes true or becomes prescient or just valuable insight, something to really consider. It's hard to do that with nonfiction, but we'll let everyone read your book and go through that experience on their own. But I'd love to transition to so what some of those things are that you're looking at. We love to explore kind of how is AI going to disrupt the world? What does it mean for us? And so I would love to explore some of your thoughts on that in a nonfiction way outside of the book, just some of your thoughts and opinions of where do you see things going? What are you maybe most excited about? Or where are some areas that you're concerned about that you think people, it would be high value for them to understand so that they can make better use of AI and adapt to the world that's coming?
So the thing is that things that excite me is the whole aspect of the singularity and general artificial intelligence and self-awareness is not something that I think is even on my radar. I think that the concept of the Turing test, for example, is an outdated way of understanding what is intelligence. And we can be very easily fooled by things like GPTs or chatbot-based approaches. that they, but I like to describe those as they're Play-Doh extruders. You shove the Play-Doh in, and then you put some pressure on it, and it squeezes something else out of the back end that it's been, the model has created, right? And that's all it is. It's a lot of that. Our language is very predictable. The way we communicate is mathematical almost. And so our, and so you can, I look at statistical probabilities of what to say, and then you'll output things that sound whole human because you've modeled them off of human. It does not make it sentient. And so the thing that makes, that I find interesting about those tools like GPT, for example, is it makes things that were, but that were, they were frustrating because they were tedious. It automates them and makes them easier. And that's the part that excites me, is things that were previously tedious are now within reach, and that are could be done much faster. And a lot of times we talk about artificial intelligence and robotics, we deal with the three Ds, the dull, the dirty, and the dangerous. So the those things that you don't want to do because they're either disgusting, because it's like trash cleanup or cleaning out a septic tank, you could send a robot in there to do that. Things like going into combat, the robot can die. Nobody cares if a robot dies. It's just money, okay? That's great. I'd rather that die than a person dies. And same thing with the dull, okay? So what I think is funny is when you talk about automation and people being frustrated that they're losing their jobs, the jobs that are going away because of automation are jobs people don't really want to do anyway. It's just that's where the economy happens to be. So people are like, hey, the factory shut down. Now our town has no jobs. I can see that being impactful, but it's going that direction anyway. 150 years ago, those factories didn't exist anyway. So what were you doing for work? How were you spending your time? And the rejection that we're having nowadays of the typical 9-to-5 is another, just an extension of that. People don't want their lives to be owned by a salary-based job that dictates to them how much time they can spend doing something. They don't want that anymore. Well, automation makes that easier. You have the ability to expand on automated processes that make your life easier. It helps search for solutions that make your life easier. And those are the things I'm excited about. The things I'm not excited about are not so much based on robotics. They're almost entirely focused on disinformation and social media. That's something that scares me. And it has less to do with the AI and more to do with people. Is looking at shows like The Social Dilemma or looking at what Cambridge Analytica did with Facebook data to manipulate elections. That's the kind of thing you're going to see proliferating. And you're going to see people passing information that is untrue and then living in different realities, which we already know happening right now. That's the thing that's going to get worse with AI, because you can automate those processes as well. And that is something that I write about in my books, about how the psyche of a society can be manipulated in real time and to someone's advantage. And you can proliferate that at scale. And then you can have them, you can manipulate it however you need it to, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. And one of the things I'm exploring actually in my recent book is, how easy is it for someone to do that and turn it on and off like a faucet when you want a political uprising to take place and then shut it off at the flip of a switch? Can you do it? And I believe you can. And I believe AI is making it easier. And then you could also go back and rewrite history. And I mean, you're seeing that right now. People are, things that we know for a fact happened 4 years ago, we're suddenly looking back and being like, "Ah, we don't need to worry about that. It didn't really happen the way we said it did." And that's the part that AI is manipulating and changing in real time. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's certainly concerning. And one of the things that I've thought a lot about is just this concept of how noisy it makes things. You know, it's sort of, as it proliferates the ability to create information. And I don't even really like that term, because I sort of have a higher standard for what information is than text or data. But that being said, information or just data really is what we're creating at scale. Lots of data, lots of words, lots of articles, lots of perceptions, whatever. Like, all of that being created at such a big scale means that it's really noisy. And if it's really noisy, people start to filter down and they end up in those echo chambers you talked about, or these alternate realities. And
that problem
seems extremely challenging to solve.
Yeah, it's like you said, it's noisy. The other problem is we share information via reels and factoids. Now, when I say a factoid, I say it's something that is presented as a fact, but may not be truthful. And when we ingest factoids, we ingest it to reinforce our worldview, not because we're trying to learn something. It's because we believe something, and then we want other people that agree with that to tell us the same thing. That's why if you go on YouTube and you click on a video, it starts showing you exact same types of video as your factoids reinforcing a worldview. That's and because the fact that the algorithm has taught us that that's how you're entertained, and that keeps you there. And so it's literally those algorithms forcing you into those different directions. We all know this. This is common knowledge. But this falls into another element that is referred to as mimetic warfare. Mimetic warfare comes from the original term meme, which is a Charles Dawkins term, which refers to the changing of social DNA through the exchange of information. So, for example, you and I are talking and we're sharing experiences, things that we know about our lives, things that are happening. Me planting the idea in your head is me exchanging a meme. That is the idea, okay? As we began to expand on the idea of a meme, we started turning them into images that we could share information of, and that turned into what we call a meme nowadays. But a meme is a form of information exchange that reinforces a worldview. And a while back, they were talking about how there was a war with memes, and there might even friends of mine were like, that's stupid. What they didn't understand is mimetic warfare is the exchanging of ideas to change your social DNA. And when I change your social DNA, I change your worldview. And I change your worldview by reinforcing factoids, not by reinforcing facts. I want to create cognitive dissonance in that particular case, not me personally, but an individual running that. If I can reinforce your cognitive dissonance, I can isolate you. And if I isolate you, I can radicalize you. And that's how cults do it. That's how our political parties are doing it. That's how ideologists are doing it, is they're just reinforcing worldviews. And here's the thing, the reason why I call it a factoid. How often do we see something on a reel that's being passed as truth that we look up to determine whether or not it's truth? Or do we just listen and go, that's interesting, and then keep going? Almost every time we ingest information to those means, we see it, we take it in, we don't second guess it. We don't wonder where it's coming from or the motivation of the individual posting it. We just say, wow, that's crazy. And then we scroll up to the next one. It's reinforcing a worldview.
There's really only two scripts there. It's really, it hits our psyche and we say, if I agree with that, I will file it as fact right away. If I disagree with that, maybe it's interesting. Maybe I just am extremely skeptical of it because the internet can always be a lie. So we almost have this concept of we know that everything could be fake on the internet, and we know we can't trust anything on the internet. So then the only filter that seems to get applied is, well, if I agree with it, I'll assume it's real, even if I haven't checked. And if I disagree with it, you can never trust the internet. And so really makes it reduces our cognitive processing to kind of a very base level.
Yeah, it uses our own ability to differentiate between truth and falsehood against us, because we don't apply that litmus test to everything we receive. Once again, is it reinforcing our worldview, or is it challenging it? We don't want our worldviews challenged. We don't like it. It's not comfortable. I don't like being told. It's like I can give so many examples, but it'll sound like I'm getting political, and I'm not intending to get political, but there's so many examples of people taking that exact same approach to every one of their topics and using it to reinforce and justify their argument, because they'll say, hey, present this argument to somebody, and when they have a visceral response or they get angry, that just justifies the fact that they have cognitive dissonance. And that's what I think is funny about it, is it's total manipulation. Because it assumes, should already assume everybody has cognitive dissonance at some level. Everybody does. However, you recognize the fact that you have it doesn't mean you're willing to confront it, right? So that's the part is, and that's the thing that we used to do a much better job at. you and I as human beings could have a conversation and find middle ground every time. I don't care who you are. Two human beings can find a middle ground somewhere. But if I'm online and I never have to face you individually face to face, I never have to deal with your world problems or see things from your perspective, I can just comment on a video and then send it. And there's no repercussions for that. And that has allowed us all to become a society of cowards. And that is when it comes back to the conversation of AI, when you enable society writ large to act in a cowardly manner that makes them think that they are being strong. Once again, there's another form of cognitive dissonance. No one has any strength by making some jerk statement on Instagram. Sorry, I don't know who you are, trolling somebody. That is just, it is there just to create emotional responses out of people for fun. And some people will do that, and that's fine, but it's not fine. It's not cool at all. But I guess to some people, that's what they want to do. But so the main point I'm trying to get to is you can build bots that do this. You can have people that fall into that path. But the thing is, to quote Bo Bergdahl when he says this, but not Bo Bergdahl, sorry, Bo, the comedian. Bo Bergdahl was the army guy that got rolled up by the Taliban. No, Bo Dunham. I think it's Bo Dunham. He said that like applications and software companies are trying to colonize your mind. Okay. And it's because they're trying to take your free time. And if you find yourself in a spot where you scroll too much on social media, if you scroll more than a minute and a half, you're wasting your time. Unless you have a specific reason to do it, you are losing your life by doing it. Now, I'm not trying to lecture people using social media. That's not what I'm trying to get at. Use it in a way that heals and strengthens you and makes you better and teaches you things. Don't use it as a means of just allowing the internet to colonize your mind.
Yeah, it's a really important distinction. And you know, that one of my favorite quotes is from an old motivational speaker, but a man that I really got a lot of value from early in my life. And his name is Jim Rohn. And he says, stand guard at the door of your mind. And it's a mentor that taught that to him, one of his early mentors. And it's something that I find myself thinking more and more and more, and just feeling is this skill or this recognition that people need more than ever. One of the most high leverage things I see. It's funny. Most of the entrepreneurs I meet, it could be politically left, politically right. They could be different backgrounds, religious, not religious. Any of these things that have become these polarizing topics, you know, that you're talking about, these echo chambers online, et cetera, could be from any of those. And yet those people, these people that are highly successful, and again, it's a generalization, it's not everybody, but a lot of the people I meet, highly successful, they pay very close attention about what's going into their mind. And it doesn't mean that makes them more right than someone else. I'm not saying people that are really successful are more right than other people. That's not the point. What I'm saying is, whatever their objective is, they're really clear about, I got to be careful about what I'm going into my mind. And what that means is actually a lot of my friends spend very little time on social media. Even people who are posting a ton on social media, they have teams that do it for them. For myself, I have people that post for me on social media. This podcast, I don't post any of them. I want as much separation as possible. And a lot of people do this. And increasingly, it's getting common. But people who need to spend their time productively towards anything, and it, just for me, my group of people that I interact with on that tends to be a lot of entrepreneurs, they recognize, okay, I have to be more careful about what I let into my mind, because as soon as I let it in, it's a distraction. Even if it's not a bad distraction, it's something that's going to populate my mind, I'm going to waste brain power on, when I'm trying to solve this thing for my company, or my company's trying to solve this need for society, or I'm trying to grow and accomplish this goal. Someone who's really purpose-driven towards that, they're going to recognize, like, man, the reason I'm not hitting my goals is because I'm spending so much time on social media, or I've got all these distractions, or why am I constantly thinking about buying new cars? Oh, I'm getting exposed to so many ads. People are colonizing my mind. And so whatever you define success as, wherever you want to have leverage in your life, you want to go accomplish something really meaningful and purposeful, you want to achieve something in business, you want to do whatever it is, you have to learn that principle. And it's increasingly important because, like you said, there's this targeted assault on our minds, this colonization of our minds. If you don't stand guard at your mind, no one will. Everyone else is wanting that door wide open, and they have their own agenda that they're putting in there. And so I think a lot about this. I'm worried about it. Honestly, for future generations, we've got to find ways to help them learn this and protect themselves. I don't even let my kids have most technology, and everyone thinks we're dumb. And I'm like, look, yes, they're going to have to learn it eventually. Yes, we're going to have to introduce them and teach them skills to deal with it. But they're six, and they just don't need to touch it, because they need to learn, they need to have some distinction between their mind and what's getting put into their mind. And my biggest fear for a lot of young people today is they can't hear the difference. See, I lived before cell phones existed, right? And I know you have been alive a little longer than me. And so we have this immense privilege that I think people don't realize or is easy to take for granted of knowing the difference. If we think about it, you can also just forget it. But if you think about it, you can think of a time when your brain was not on total assault constantly. Sure, when you turn on the TV, maybe there was a little bit of stuff being planted. When you, you know, interacted in certain ways. But if you were outdoors playing as a kid, the majority of the time, you know a certain existence that kids today, many kids, if not most, the vast majority, have never experienced, where you knew your own thoughts, you confronted your own thoughts. It wasn't all being planted and a huge amount just being constantly assaulted and planted and colonized by these tech companies. And if you remember that, then you have something to compare to, and now you can make a choice. You can't choose between options you don't know exist, right? And so, or at least it's hard to. You got to become aware that there are options to choose from. And so we have this huge privilege as those of us that lived prior to this type of dystopian, in some ways, existence that we're in. And so I'm curious what you think, how do we then help going forward? How do we teach people or younger generations? How do we build up this skill where people can stand guard at the door of their mind? They can recognize and delineate between my thoughts and I'm being influenced by, and then really start to interrogate and find the difference between facts and factoids, find my own opinions, find connection to humans and wrestle with that and find middle ground. Is there anything that you think people should really pay attention to see progress in that area?
I think a good example is that we used Gen Z as guinea pigs to figure out what it's like to live in a world with constant internet access. And we're seeing the repercussions of that with an entire generation that has anxiety medications and has a hard time understanding their own identity. And it's as well as seeing online and virtual personas as if they are real and that they are not contrived. And you are seeing, I think you're starting to see the realization of what that problem is, but it's going to take discipline on the part of parents. I am with you. I have a 12-year-old daughter and she is not allowed to watch YouTube or has any social media accounts. She doesn't have a phone. She has a Gab watch, which is a watch that allows her to call us or send us text messages. And that's it. And we know where she is. That's the only reason why it exists, is because if we need to get a hold of her while she's at dance or at school, we can. That's the only reason why the watch exists. There's no anything else. There were studies done by the late 2010s that show that teenage girls in middle school that started on Instagram and social media were 40% more likely to cut themselves. It goes on and on, and we all know this. That's why they even say on the warning label that you can't 14 plus. The Chinese on TikTok don't allow. They have a different variant of TikTok that they have for their the people in their country, and the children aren't even allowed to use it. Everything, all the content is different. They don't allow certain things because they know what it'll do. Now, granted, they do it because they're trying to control the narrative within their country, and it's a communist state, so of course they don't want you doing anything against the party. So freedom of speech doesn't exist. However, they use freedom of speech as a weapon against us. Stalin even said, if Americans hadn't created freedom of speech, I would have created it for them. Because he knew how well he could use it as a weapon against us. We have the problem with, we are a nation and a society that focuses on our agency, but we don't understand how to discipline ourselves in moderation. So we do think everything in excess. We drink in excess. We focus on pornography in excess. That, you know, I mean, you look at the explosion of things like OnlyFans. Like that, the reason why that exists is because we don't know how to do things in moderation. And that's because we have told ourselves that we need to give into these things. Now, the social media and all that, what it does is it gives us a dopamine dump at our fingertips. And if you can tell how bad your dopamine dump is by recognizing how often you have to touch your phone. Put your phone down and then ask, every time you find yourself reaching for it, what happens? And why do you reach for it? What do you do when you open it? Where do you go? You immediately recognize what's going on. There's a tool that I have that basically tells me every single time I open something, that tells me why I opened it and how long I dwelled using that one thing. And recently there's certain things on my phone that I even when I got rid of something else replaced it. So I stopped, I had no social media on there. but I'd play this one game. I played the game too much. So I deleted the game. I was like, this is taking up too much of my time. I can't do it anymore. Then I found myself checking the news. The news hadn't changed, but I kept checking it. Why was I looking at it? It's because I was having this physical reaction to it. And so then now I'm at the point where it's not perfect, but at certain times of day, the phone gets put on the charger and stays there. And I have a watch. I have an Apple Watch in case someone contacts me. But other than that, I don't touch my phone. I don't need to. There's no reason for it. Am I okay with it being in the other room? If I need to do some type of entertainment, it's something I can do with my kids together, not something that we do in isolation. We don't like everybody being alone on their iPads. We don't. The only reason the iPad exists is because we go on trips, right? Or we use it as an alarm clock or something like that. That's pretty much the extent of what they're for. And so those are things that, when it comes to the next generation, need to learn the discipline associated with what they think went wrong. Because we have a lot of, I was reading an article today that just said that we live in a generation of chicken littles. And everything that you read is talking about how the sky is falling. Now, imagine children who have access to that and access to these factoids constantly dumping on them that the sky is falling. Of course they have anxiety. And we wonder where it's coming from. When we were kids, when I was a kid, dude, I was just on my bike. My existential threat was actually a literal existential threat. It was from gangs. But if I knew how to avoid those areas, so I stayed away. And I knew I was too busy interacting in my environment in a real way. And so I had to go to the library to learn these things. And so that's the aspect that I would go walk, the thing to walk away with from this conversation is just that we control and are masters of the destiny of our own mind and what we're trying to get out of it. And we should discipline ourselves to recognize that on a daily basis, small steps lead to greater success, and that you need to create a rhythm in your life. Right now, is that rhythm of your life you sacrificing your time to look at something that gives you nothing in return? If you look at social media all day long, what do you get in the back end from it? Be surgical about how you ingest things into your life. Like you said, being a gatekeeper to your own mind. But AI from a certain standpoint is going to make any of those things better or make them worse. It is, I've said this before, but it is a reflection of the model that of who created it. And we created it. So it's reflecting back on us, that which we fed it to begin with. And so if we don't like what it is, it's because it's a reflection of ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a powerful way to maybe start to close here. I think I've done similar experiments. I did an experiment where I lived without a phone for 3 months. It changed my life, was wonderful. But there were certain limitations and things where I said, okay, I'm going to go back. I'm going to bring the phone back in. But now I'm going to live with these new set of rules. I've done things where everything I've done, the most durable thing I found, let's put it this way. I'm in favor. I think people at minimum need to do some small fasts to wake up again, to give yourself a choice to know how much your phone is impacting your life. Because the thing that annoys me the most when people say technology is agnostic, it's just a tool. You use it for good, you use it for bad. Theoretically, that is true. But by the time it is in the form of a smartphone designed product, this is not just a technology. This is not just conceptual theoretical technology. It is custom designed. Like you said, there are clear documentaries if you are unaware, but it is custom designed to do things that will make you unhappy, to trigger emotions, to trigger chemical releases in your brain, to influence you. And it's all for the negative. It is entirely negative. It is a net negative in every way, because that's what produces the result. That's what keeps attention. Our brain is evolutionarily wired to pursue pleasure and to avoid pain. And between the two, when they compete, we avoid pain more. And so if I have to win the battle for your attention, I have to make sure you are scared. I have to make sure you're trying to avoid pain, and I have your attention. And so the battle of attention, which is all of the marketing dollars, all of the different apps, the everything, all of the money, the economy is increasingly driven through technology by fear. And so if that's the case, you have to make strong choices that are going to limit your exposure to that in some way or another, whether it's a phone fast, whether it's, like you said, using just a watch and then keeping it away. I mean, whatever you come up with, you have to come up with something. But the most durable thing for me has been working on myself, my mentality, my beliefs, so that I, like you said, that discipline, have the strength to say, I don't need this. I'm going to walk away from it. I'm going to recognize when it's influencing me. That's hard to do. I still have tons of work to do. It's not to say I'm perfect, but you have to do that. And the other thing I think people have to do is they have to make sure they give their kids a choice. And you can't give your kid a choice if they've always been exposed. You have to give them, you have to create space in their life. And I'm not out here trying to tell everyone how to be parents, but if we don't find a way to give our kids an experience where they know the difference, they know what it's like to go live in the present and experience reality and have self-confidence and find self-worth, then how could we ever expect them not to end up on a horrible path where they're just, social media is destroying them, they're doing plastic surgeries, they're, you know, all of these things that we've seen, the outcomes of skyrocketing people trying to make themselves look like their filters, trying to make, you know, high levels of anorexia and eating disorders and just all these deep emotional problems that people are suffering through, kids are suffering through. It's our responsibility, not just to discipline ourselves, but to give those kids a choice and to help make sure that this doesn't destroy their lives. And so I think we have enough data. It's too late to pretend we don't know. And it'll work out. You know, tech is ubiquitous. We can't make excuses. We've got to look in the mirror and be honest with ourselves about the fact that there are real consequences. We've got to protect kids and give them a chance to really live a life where they can separate, where they can make those choices. So this conversation has been a blast for me. It's been great to speak with you. Jim, if people are listening to this, they're going, man, this is really insightful. I really want to go read this book, as well as maybe the sequel that's coming out. Where can people find you and where do they find your book so that they can read it?
You can find my book anywhere. It's called The Hawk Enigma, basically. But if you go to my website, jlhancock.com, you can also sign up for my newsletter. But I also have a blog post where I write about some of the technologies in my books, a book, soon to be books, and then also has links for where you can purchase. It's available on audio as well as a hardback and paperback.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to go listen to it, most likely on Audible, if it's on Audible, because I get a lot of audiobooks on there.
And pretty much any audio.
And I'm excited to support everything you're doing and appreciate both your service to the country as well as what you're doing now to make an impact on such an important frontier here. So thank you for everything you're doing, Jim. Thanks for being here and to stay in touch.
All right. Thank you.
Hey, before you go, I have a small request. Our mission is to empower as many people as possible to maximize their potential through the power of leverage. Could you help us in this mission by leaving a review on iTunes, Spotify, or YouTube? And if you know just one person who would benefit from today's episode, would you please share it with them? Your support means the world to us, and we are thrilled to have you in the community. Thank you for being a part of our journey and helping us grow. You can find show notes for today's show and past shows at lessonsinleverage.com. which also has links to connect with me personally and connect with our various podcast channels across your favorite social networks. A big thanks to Solve.cloud, who sponsored this episode. They're a group of expert consultants that help SaaS and financial services companies to implement, optimize, and manage Salesforce.com. They can help you with custom integration solutions and are helping customers to implement some of the most important generative AI technologies. You can find them at Solve.cloud. That's SOLVD.cloud is the URL. Thanks again, and we'll talk soon.